So a couple of people astutely noticed that I skipped a few lines of the Metta Sutta. And I consciously did that because it's I wanted to take the time to address the I had spent pretty much a full hour talking about the Metta Sutta up to that point. I don't want to open up this can of worms and go on longer. So, but it the Metta Sutta ends, and it's sort of the, you know, there's this laying the basis and foundation of the Metta Sutta, of the cultivation of Metta, which is in terms of conduct and speech and how one lives in the world, and then goes into the actual cultivation of the loving kindness itself, and giving different parameters and guidelines and encouragement, and then that sense of say, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. And then the sutta ends, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. And with just a cursory glance, one might think, how did that get tacked on? That doesn't have anything to do with metta. But I think that is actually how one brings metta to complete fruition, is by not holding to fixed views, having the insight and understanding to be not being caught in views, opinions, attachment to one's perspective, and being freed from all sense desires. This radical relinquishing of attachment, so that's really something that for loving kindness to really manifest and, as I say, come into fruition, really being able to undermine the fundamental roots of attachment and defilement, clinging, and that. So then it takes metta practice. It ramps it up a whole other level of bringing it into an insight practice, into a liberating insight practice. So that. Because when we're, as we cultivate loving kindness, one of the things is of course, say the heart gets more attuned to, say, its own movement. We start to feel more clearly the movement within the heart. The kind of, wanting to take a fixed view, having a position, that feeling of contention, feeling of butting up against something, somebody, something, and a feeling of conflict, and say, how does one deal with that? Does one just swamp it with loving kindness and make it go away? It's one way. Or does one sort of, what's the root of that? What's the root of that feeling of having to hold a view of right or wrong, good or bad. Sort of, this is correct, this is incorrect. It's got to be this way, it can't be that way. What's the root of that? Because the root of that is in a sense of self, sense of I am. And the metta practice is a very skillful means of softening the heart, opening the heart, so that it's actually able to tune in and sort of say, well, that's suffering. Even if you're right, it's still suffering. Well, of course, we're always right. But it's painful to be right. So that sense of how we prop up views and how we prop up positions, and then land in places of suffering. I had such loving kindness going. How'd they get back to this point of suffering again? I said, well, that's the way it works when there's still greed, hatred, and delusion, when there's still the underlying roots of the asava, the outflows. And the practice of loving kindness, in order to come to fruition, is then we need to be shining a light on that aspect of what are the sort of deeper rooted tendencies, and how do we work with them, and of course, absolutely, one of the ways of working with it is with loving kindness, in the sense of if one then sets up oneself in opposition and in conflict with one's own mind, then you're in a constant source of conflict. So that the kindest act that one can do is let go of defilement, let go of attachment, and that's the sort of the kindest thing that we can do for ourselves and others. Using the practice and training that we're doing, that cultivation of love and kindness, as a means of highlighting that where we do create a sense of being opposition, conflict, aspects of where we hold to a particular view, and the that sense of how important the views are to those underlying tendencies within the mind. The way the Buddha outlined what were the outflows, asavas, was outlined it as three, with sort of desire, sensual desire, becoming, and ignorance, or not knowing, avijja, not knowing, not having true knowledge. And it was very soon after the Buddha's passing that the commentators and teachers added the outflow of views, because it seemed so fundamental as well, and that that this is a source of both a source of suffering, but it's a source of perpetuating the round of rebirth. So views are seen very, I say, deeply rooted in the mind. And even if we if it's not sort of argumentative views, it's still sort of having to take a position, having to be right or wrong, being having a place on the spectrum of how we view things. It's like in the Buddha's time, and there's a whole sort of list of standard views that for us it's probably not so meaningful, but in the Buddha's time these were the philosophical positions of the day, and there were whole schools of religious seekers and philosophers who took various positions. And so there is the cosmos eternal, or is it not eternal? You know, what's the nature of the self? What's the nature of the body and the mind? What is it? Is an enlightened being? Do they exist after death? Do they not exist after death? Do they both exist and not exist after death? Or do they neither exist or not exist after death? You know, you have philosophical debates and conflicts about this, whole schools. If they were in a more modern setting, and well, pick your view of choice, but there's a discourse where Ananda goes in to a wanderer's park, and it was around Rajagir, because they talked about going to the hot springs, and and he meets a wanderer, and the wanderer immediately starts questioning him about, do you know who what. What teacher do you follow? Well, I'm a follower. I'm a son of the Sakyan, Gotama. And he said, well, what view does he hold? Does he hold that the cosmos is eternal? He said it's not eternal. Is there an end to it? Is there not an end to it? Is there all of these positions? He runs through the whole litany and says, we don't hold that view. No, we don't hold that view. We don't hold that view. No, we don't hold that view. And he said, it gets to the end of all of these basic positions. What do you hold to? And so, and he phrases it really nicely in the sense that they say as a son of the Sakyan contemplative, we don't hold those particular views because we pay attention to the arising of views, the basis of the arising of views, and then it's internalized, and by paying attention to those. At that basis of the arising of views, then we're able to be free of views and positions. And it's a wonderful perspective to be, one. Because, views can, opinions, attachments, perspectives, it isn't as if, to sort of be accomplished in not having views, then one is this sort of this space cadet. Just completely out there, and incapable of asking a question. By recognizing that how one starts to fix oneself into a position and seeing, oh, I'm putting myself in opposition to that person or to that situation by holding that view, and that's going to lead to suffering. Then one's able to step back from that, position taking that view, holding to views, and that allows one to return to a place of mindfulness and clear comprehension, of discernment. And that's what one takes as one's abiding place. Or by recognizing that whatever view does come up, well, that's just a mental formation within the mind. Well, that's just that's just a thought. That's just a perception. One can have a perception about something and realize it's impermanent and realize that it's unsatisfactory and realize that it's non-self. And sometimes one can act on those views or those perceptions if they have a usefulness at that particular time, but it's sort of, well, but they're not, one's not building one's home within that or building one's concrete sense of self within that. And again, tying that in with loving kindness, that's it's very kind to oneself and to others, because you can, if it doesn't take very long to try to recollect the last time one was at loggerheads with somebody because of a particular view. And then you think about it after, why did I even go there? You know, what was the point of that anyway? So that sense of by not being trapped by that, then one can respond. Usually, one can respond quite skillfully, and that is. It's exceedingly useful. As we reflect on that, that sense of non-contention as a basis for loving kindness, that because it's when we do hold a particular view, or we're attaching to a particular view or perspective, then the nature of there's an idiom in the scriptural language that describes that mental state. This is right; everything else is wrong. And it isn't as if one has consciously thought that out, or even articulates that within the mind, but that's actually how it is, in the sense of that's what we feel at that particular moment. We can change, and we usually do, but it's sort of at that particular moment, that's what it feels like. This is right, everything else is wrong. And as soon as we're in that kind of position, that's the basis for contention. That's the basis for conflict. That's the basis for whether it's short or protracted, a feeling of irritation, aversion, ill will is going to be attendant on holding that particular view, so that trying to make that very conscious through the cultivation of loving kindness to allow those view forming to not be so strong, to have a sense of loving kindness, well wishing toward oneself. Again, because we're the first, usually the first person to suffer when we're tightly locked into a particular view, and then of course for others. So that active application of loving kindness, it's not just something that is kind of a nice emotion that you are able to generate while you're sitting on your cushion sometimes, but it's this very practical application of how we can interface with the world around us, and not be trapped by fixed views, by not holding to fixed views. So it just lays a basis for peace and clarity. One of the underlying principles of the Dhamma that the Buddha pointed to is this aspect of letting go, of relinquishing, of putting down. And when we're able to to let go, then when we can let go of a mood of irritation, aversion, we can let go of a sense of a view that's starting to arise. When we can let go of a particular perspective of how I think it actually has to be. And letting go of sense desires, letting go of the whole construct of I am. It's that letting go that allows one to access or to experience sort of real peace. And there's in a few places in the discourses where the Buddha is asked, what is the way to formulate these teachings in a very succinct way, and in the Pali, sambhe dhamma nalang apini vesaya, which means that all dhammas are not to be clung to. All dhammas are not worthy of holding on to. All dhammas are not to be attached to. Something like that. And, or all things. When we say dhammas, sort of all, it's sort of small d, sort of all things. All things are to be not worthy of clinging to. And that's it's a very simple phrase that is helpful for practice, in the sense of especially if we're in terms of say of metta bhavana, if we think of, well, what are the obstructions that come up in the mind? Well, if we get entangled in them, try to analyze them, try to figure them out too much, sort of just hook you in. But just to be able to come from that place of, all things are not to be clung to. So there's maybe a mood of distraction, a mood of irritation, a mood of confusion. But they all dhammas are not to be clung to. And then that bringing into being the cultivation of loving kindness, which is it's an expansive, wholesome quality, which one has a sense of trying, and ultimately one has to let go of it. But it's again this useful bridge, so that one can be putting one's effort and attention into things that help to establish a sense of peace and clarity, and to help to sustain that. So that act of letting go is a very, very, very useful tool. And then one of the places that teaching comes up is, I mean, it's actually a very interesting discourse, because it's actually quite a well-known teaching that most people, if you've been on a meditation retreat, or so, you've probably heard it referred to in some way or another, in the sense that it's the discourse given to Moggallana when he was meditating and experiencing drowsiness. And it was in the shortly after Moggallana ordained. He's sort of practicing diligently, but being overcome by sloth and torpor, drowsiness. And the Buddha comes and gives him instruction. And that set of instructions on, first make your object of meditation clear. If that doesn't work, then to use an image of light to bring brightness to the mind. Use a recitation. If that doesn't work, if the image of brightness doesn't work, use a recitation. If that doesn't work, pull your ears, rub your skin, try to get something going, get some energy going somehow. that doesn't work. Go out and look at the sky, look at the stars. If that doesn't work, do walking meditation. Sort of all of these things. If that doesn't work, do this. If that doesn't work, do that. In the end, if none of it works, just lay down and have a rest, mindfully establishing the time for getting up and continuing your practice. But then the discourse continues on, and which usually when it's referred to, that's the bit that's referred to. And then the Buddha continues and gives Moggallana instruction in being careful not to get too involved with lay people, laity, getting caught up in drawing too close. He says, because lay people have busy lives, and if you're trying to be a part of their lives, and then they ignore you, then you're sort of, and say, "Well, what did I do wrong?" It's just sort of, there's just endless complications. You're a monk, do what monks do. And lay people do what lay people do. Don't get too entangled in other people's lives. And then he gives him instruction in speech and maintaining a sense of a circumspection in speech, because inevitably, once you get into a lot of conversation, leads to a lot of talking, a lot of conflict. There's always misunderstandings. There's always some sort of conflict arise when there's a lot of it exchanging. Just restrain oneself in speech. Paying attention to maintaining humility and not being proud wherever you go, whatever you do. So there's, you know, good instructions for a new monk. And then Moggallana asked the Buddha, "Well, what is what's the sort of the core of the teachings? And, what is its basis?" And that's where the Buddha says, fundamental teachings are all dhammas are not to be clung to. And so when you don't cling to things, then you're not building sort of the momentum of the habits and attachments. When you're not building the habit and that momentum of habits and attachments, then you're not creating a sense of being sustained by them. When you're not being sustained by all of those habit patterns, then you can actually dwell free and unsustained by within the world and within the body-mind complex. So that's a wonderful teaching. That's very, very, very direct. And as we reflect and investigate and seeing just how that process of views, attachment to our sense of self and our sense of what we think is right, what we think is wrong, how things should be, how things shouldn't be. There's endless amount of frustration, agitation that's going on all the time, and that's a source of dukkha. So that the position for the Buddhist perspective is not that you're trying to sort of just wipe it all out and annihilate that, but you're trying to understand the reason why one takes a position, a view, and by seeing that dynamic of that movement of mind that has to have a position of I am, I am right, I am wrong, I am good, I am not good, I'm correct, I'm wrong again. All of these positions that we take, it's like the way the Buddha structured when the word conceit in Buddhism has a whole different sort of level of meaning. As we normally use it in the English language, because there's these nine different bases of conceit. Being inferior, assuming oneself to be inferior, being inferior, assuming oneself to be equal, being inferior, assuming oneself to be superior, being equal, assuming oneself to be inferior, being equal, assuming oneself to be equal, being equal, assuming oneself to be superior, being superior, assuming oneself to be inferior, being superior, assuming oneself to be equal, and being superior, assuming oneself to be superior. It's like, that is all the basis of conceit. So it's just trying to take a position all the time. And you say that you realize all of that is suffering. That is how we create our suffering. It's trying to, who am I, where am I in this realm of relating to myself and the world around me in comparison to others. As soon as you go there, you're trapped. So that they, again, the bringing it back to to kindness or metta, that's just sort of the, that's, may I abide in well-being. You know, may all beings abide in well-being. That's a much safer position than being able to drop and put aside, set aside all of that. The I-making and mind-making, let's see. Because that's what we're making it. It isn't as if the I and me and mine is an actual fixed entity. This is something we are doing all of the time. We're constantly doing it, and that's the it's very really clear in that in the Pali language with that ahankara mamankara, which is it's that. Kara is like the verb to do. The I doing and the mind doing. This is what you're making. We're making it. We're doing it. We're creating. And of course, what is it, like the Sorcerer's Apprentice? You do it, and boy, it's all there in Fantasia. Everything is there, the whole schmear. So the teachings of the Buddha are giving us the tools to be able to allow that to be let go of, to be put down, to be dropped. And of course, that's a doing as well, but that's part of the cultivation of a practice is that putting attention. We need to be doing something, and on a certain level, we're doing something all the time. It's just the nature of there's something happening in terms of body, mind, but we can put attention to the. Say the act of relinquishment, the act of kindness. And those are very conscious acts that reap the fruits of well-being and peace. And I'd say sort of one needs to remind oneself to just like that sense, one should sustain this recollection. That's okay. This is a reminding oneself, a recollecting, mindful application. As we relinquish as I say, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. And that somebody who is freed from all sense desires and is not born again into this world is Anagami and an arahant, non-returner, somebody who is a fully enlightened being. And that's a real act of kindness. To be somebody who is able to fully penetrate the teachings and to be completely free of the entanglements of samsara. That's a I think of course the closest example to me is Ajahn Chah. Sort of the effect that he's had on, that's a contemporary example. The Buddha His example is still resonating 2,500 years, and that's a tremendous effect on the world by that act of relinquishment, being able to be freed from all sense desires, recognizing, okay, that not that act of turning away from the cycle of samsara, and that and it has a extraordinarily powerful effect. I think the Gajahn Cha, both being one because he's contemporary to me, and it was his example of loving kindness, and his ability to inspire people to practice. It's like in Thailand, they I don't know how many monasteries are affiliated with Ajahn Chah. It's several hundred, and of course the Western Sangha has America, Canada, England, France, Switzerland, Germany, Italy, New Zealand, Australia, monasteries and places have grown up. And it's just from this kind of small kind of bullfrog who, and it's like he's sit on his lily pad in the middle of this monastery. Everybody came to him. And and his both his loving kindness, but the loving kindness is really again, it's it really comes to fruition through that commitment to relinquishment. And that was one of the things when he was asked, well, what is it that what seems to have made the difference to you? Why do you seem so? And he said, well, he said, I always wanted to find an end to things. And that's, he wasn't really satisfied. He really found an end. And he had a lot of difficulty in practice. It wasn't easy for him. But I think also on a certain level I think it probably made him a lot more sort of kind and compassionate, in a sense. He could definitely sort of take in the foibles of the rest of us. But his sort of ability to see through, and it isn't as if, say, like when we say his this loving kindness, it wasn't as if he was without sort of anger or aversion, ill will, because that there's a nice story of him where he was sitting and teaching, as he usually is, would be underneath his dwelling place, and a palm reader, astrologer, was visiting, and then was captivated by his humor and his warmth, And then finally screwed up the courage to ask him if he could sort of look at his hands, the lines on his hand. And of course Ajahn Chah teased him and said, "Oh, well, I'm gonna take, you know, am I going to win the lottery?" And then he starts looking at his hands and looking at them. Said, "Lumpa, by the lines in your hands, you've got a lot of anger." And Ajahn Chah smiled. He says, "Yeah, but I don't use it." it's just those simple words. You don't negate personality, temperament, and. But you also, you know, you have the wisdom and clarity to say, "Ah, I really don't want to repeat that. I've been there, done that. Time to let it go." And that actually happened at one point where Ajahn Chah was already abbot of a monastery, and you know he was a real taskmaster. He talked to the really senior monks, and it was not much fun. he was very, very strict, and there was one day when I'm not sure how long he'd been the abbot and was teaching already for some years, and then it was one of the novices was like after the meal everybody else had gone, and for some reason Ajahn Chah was walking past, and this novice had taken and then he picked up a kettle, and rather than going and finding a cup, he sort of picked up the kettle and started drinking from it. And Ajahn Chah just lost it. So one, you're not supposed, I mean, it's impolite to be standing and drinking for a monk or a novice, and then just to be, and Ajahn Chah just bolted it. He was gonna beat him. He was gonna beat this novice. And the novice saw him. He is out of there. he was out of there. And Ajahn Chah chased after him. He was going to get him and thrash him. And this novice was quicker than him and got away. And then Ajahn Chah just hit him. So, wow. And he went back to his dwelling place, and he didn't come out for 3 days. He sat and he worked with that anger. He didn't come out, he didn't go alms round, didn't go to eat, didn't do anything. And the monk said that after that occasion, nobody ever saw him display anger again. It was very, very interesting. This is painful and this is suffering, and I really got to deal with it. It was really, I think these people aren't born like this. You see teachers that are wise or compassionate. They're not born like this. It's not how it works. You work at it. And you deal with it. So that recognizing this is suffering and realizing, oh, there's a way out of this. And so that sense of seeing that, taking rebirth again and again, even if it's pleasant, it's not worth it. It's really, and to be able to, there's a tremendous gift of kindness to the world. So that's something that, you know, in each in our own way, we can be doing to what we can, or setting that intention, setting that resolution. And that metta bhavana is not a, you know, a sort of a kind of indulgent way of making yourself feel good for a little bit. It's really cultivating the roots of one's liberation and recognizing that that's of benefit to oneself and benefit to all beings. To offer that for reflection this morning.